The Jason Rance Show.
Jason Rance hosts a radio show in Seattle, and he has, as always, the details for us exclusively.
Jason Rance, our Seattle guy, is with us now.
Jason Rance, always great to have you in focus. Thank you.
Hey, Jason, I think you're all right, and thanks for being on the show.
An update on what's happening in your Pacific Northwest.
A huge Supreme Court victory for Eastern Washington. We'll tell you how it impacts the folks over there. We'll take you behind the scenes of the Tucker Carlson biography. Chadwick Moore will stop by to explain what he learned. Plus, can you actually avoid traffic this long Memorial Day weekend? If you can, we'll give you the tips this hour on The Jason Rance Show. So, let's dive in.
The monologue.
Well, as we told you yesterday, the Ron DeSantis campaign for president was announced on Twitter. It didn't quite go the way that I'm sure his team had hoped. Not his fault. Obviously, it's Twitter's fault. But we'll go with the whole line that he melted Twitter, which technically is true. But you would expect that Twitter would be able to handle the folks who are tuned in. Obviously, not only did folks on the far left attack him for that, but they just upped the ante on the attacks. And the reason why they're doing that is because they see him as a bigger threat than Donald Trump. They believe that they can beat Donald Trump because they've already been able to. The media clearly fought against Donald Trump in his reelection campaign, and it was successful. With Ron DeSantis, they see that he's got a great track record in Florida. They see his popularity in Florida. They see his positions on a number of issues that are very clearly aligned with how the majority of Americans believe, regardless of political position. It doesn't mean that a Democrat who otherwise agrees with Ron DeSantis is considered an easy vote for him, right? That's just not how the world works for a lot of folks. But he's clearly seen as a threat. And you've got the incoming fire from folks over at MSNBC. Michael Steele, who's a former RNC chairman, a guy who pretends to be a Republican, but now he bashes Republicans because it's a great living for him over at MSNBC. And he offered just the weirdest criticism today.
DeSantis is a political creature of the billionaire donor class.
What?
Of the GOP.
What are you talking
not
about?
Not from the grassroots.
Oh.
There is not a grassroots orientation
really
about him.
Okay.
And that sets up that dynamic that we're going to see play out between the moneyed interest and the established political interest versus what Trump owns, which is the folks who actually go out, work, volunteer, and vote in Republican primaries.
So there's a kernel of truth in what he said if we kind of ignore all the nonsense. In fact, it was Mike Huckabee, former governor, who made a salient point, I think, on Fox News last night.
Ron DeSantis clearly steps into the race in the number two slot, but it's a distant number two. And what Ron DeSantis does not have at this point is a fanatically loyal base of people who are as fanatically loyal to him as they are to Donald Trump.
Now, that part is true, and he is going to have to overcome that. But this idea that he's some creation of the billionaire class is just ludicrous. And the reason why Michael Steele is saying that is because he does understand the appeal of Ron DeSantis to a working class voter. Everyone clearly understands his appeal there. What Mike Huckabee is saying is right now, those voters are hardcore fans, evangelists, if you will, of Donald Trump, and will fight tooth and nail politically for Donald Trump, whereas Ron DeSantis doesn't have that level of base yet. And that's undoubtedly true. Now, could that change? 100%. It could absolutely change. And the more he's out there and the more he speaks and the more he makes the case, the higher the likelihood that he starts to develop that in a big way. It's clear, though, that he's starting from behind with Donald Trump. It's absolutely clear. But that can change on a dime. And I do think that there are a lot of Republicans who are looking for an alternative to Trump. They'll vote for Trump in a general, but they would rather have someone with significant less baggage. And let's be honest, Donald Trump has baggage. We can pretend otherwise. I don't think that does him any favors. But Ron DeSantis does not have the same amount of baggage. But that's what the media is trying to do right now, is pretend otherwise. Now this.
The interview.
Some significant news out of the Supreme Court. It was a unanimous decision in Sackett v. EPA. It has everything to do with the Clean Water Act, and it very clearly impacts positively, for once, Eastern Washington. Joining me on the line to discuss is Congressman Dan Newhouse. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Jason. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
If you could, maybe just set the stage, this case, because this has been a long time coming. How does it positively impact this state?
So you're absolutely right. The Sackett family in next door, Idaho, excuse me, has been fighting this case, for years, yeah. 15, 20 years. Their efforts to build on their property that is near Priest Lake in Idaho. And great news today, as you said, a unanimous decision by the United States Supreme Court that upholds the navigable waters rules that were put in place during the Trump administration, but that provide property owners much more freedom and certainty with what they can do with their private property. The old rules, the ones which the Biden administration have been working hard to re-implement, really, in my view, went way beyond the original intention of the law and covered a body of water that even maybe was an intermittent puddle. Any place that has had water in the past, may not currently, would be under the EPA's rules, which I got to tell you, were so far reaching. It was one of the most egregious overreaches by the federal government I've ever seen. In fact, it prevented farmers, for instance, from even practicing everyday agricultural techniques, plowing a field, for instance. I know personally a farmer in California who was fined under the WOTUS rules for plowing his field. Digging a hole for a fence post in the case in the Sackett, building a house on their property even because it was near a body of water, which was not connected to a stream or a river, precluded them from building on their property. So I think this unanimous ruling today really is a victory for private property owners in this country. And like I said, provides that much needed thing, and that certainty that people can utilize their property to their benefit.
And just so people understand, we're talking about a very specific portion of the ruling, the bulk of the ruling in a specific case as being unanimous. It was 5-4 when you look at the new test that the Supreme Court decided on that would be used to see whether or not, whether we're talking about the Clean Water Act or the EPA in a more general sense is utilizing a little bit too much authority. So that was 5-4. But again, that was still in the favor of the quote unquote Republican perspective on this. At the same time, you're also very much involved in the war against fentanyl. You just launched the Central Washington Fentanyl Task Force. How is it going to combat fentanyl use?
Well, thank you for bringing up something that I think is one of the most important issues that communities, not only in Central Washington or Washington State, are facing, but really, Jason, throughout our country. And that's this issue of fentanyl, this illicit drug that's coming into the United States, much of it over our southern border, is truly devastating our communities. I think the number for last year, people dying from drug overdoses is something over 120,000. That's almost double the number of people that were killed during the Vietnam War. It's just a terrible thing that's happening, truly a crisis. And so we've been talking about what can we do, and a lot of frustration not knowing what the answer to that question is. So we decided to form this task force, bring together people from all different kinds of areas of expertise. We've got members of law enforcement. We have addiction treatment groups represented, certainly medical professionals, drug court officials, school resource officers, as well as, local elected leaders and local elected tribal leaders coming together with trying to put together ideas that would be helpful in this crisis. And I think, I'm very hopeful that we will have concrete direction on what we can do at local, state, and federal levels to help win this war. As far as I know, this is the only fentanyl task force in the state of Washington. I may be wrong about that. And by saying that on your show, if there's any other effort out there, mm-hmm. I want to hear from them so we can benefit from their work.
100%, because the issue is a lot of times work like this is undermined by a quote-unquote harm reduction strategy. And last question for you, we only have about a minute left, but are you convinced that whether we're talking about Yakima or Kennewick, Richland, are they using a harm reduction sort of strategy to go about treating this issue? Because it seems to only be making things worse.
Well, I don't know exactly how to answer that question, honestly, Jason. But through this task force, we're going to have these, we have law enforcement represented as well as all these other experts. So I think any of the good ideas that are out there that are being used and tried, and even we want to know what hasn't been working so we don't make any mistakes again, to put together some things that we can use to address this issue. And I'm hopeful this can be used as these solutions can be used nationwide in communities across the country.
100%.
Obviously, I'd like to see something move forward through federal law that would help the crisis. But certainly things that can be done at the local or state mm-hmm. level are just important. And I think we'll make some progress there.
Yeah.
These are all volunteers. This whole list of 20 people, they're doing this on their own time. No federal money is being put into this. This is truly a community effort to address a crisis that's plaguing all of us.
Yeah, what will definitely help is closing our border and making sure that fentanyl is getting brought into this country from the Mexican drug cartels. We've been talking with Congressman Dan Newhouse, a Republican from the 4th District of Washington. Thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you, Jason. Thanks for shedding some light on a really, really important issue.
Absolutely. It's incredibly important. Now this.
The interview.
Well, we're about to head into a Memorial Day weekend tomorrow, Friday. Folks are likely to get on the road, find themselves in a position where they wish they had waited. Only if enough people have wished that and decide to, in fact, wait till Saturday, then it still becomes a traffic nightmare. Joining us in studio to explain maybe how we can avoid some of the craziness, Chris Sullivan from our sister station, Caro News Radio. When's just the worst possible time to leave?
About Friday between 11 a.m. and 6 p.m.
Okay.
So right about the time that everybody heads out.
Do people head out that early?
Sometimes they do. Sometimes people maybe take their kids out of school a little early and head out. Others, then those who can't do that, then realize that they're taking off at 3:30 or 4, right at kind of the peak of it. And this is no matter where you're going. Doesn't really matter.
The funny thing is there are going to be some people, like this weekend, I'm not doing anything. I'm not going anywhere. And let's say I worked a traditional job where I'm out at 5 o'clock. I would probably leave at 3:30. Offices tend to close down a little bit earlier on Memorial Day weekend. And so everyone does that. So even if I'm just trying to get home, I live Seattle to Renton or Seattle to Monroe, I'm still going to get stuck in traffic.
And primarily where you're really going to feel it are for people who live in Pierce County, because because of all the extra people heading south that then eventually maybe to get over to the beach or get over to the coast, you have to go that way primarily unless you want to take a ferry and go the long way. But so that's going to be a pain. Anybody going over I-90,
all
of our truck driver friends who are heading over, they're going to have a lot of company heading over. So that's going to be a very difficult, especially through the construction zone, as you head into Easton and Cle Elum.
There's no good way to get to Eastern Washington, really.
No.
Right? I mean, it's just, and I don't understand, there's plenty of space to expand the freeway, even if it's not I-90, just going, I forget what that stupid little town is that you got to go through to get to like the Tri-Cities area.
It's down through Yakima, whatever the city is, post-Yakima.
It's just, I don't understand why they can't make it a little bit more hospitable to drivers.
You probably could. I mean, they're
I know you could. I don't know why they don't.
Well, I mean, they're widening a part of I-90 right now through Easton. That's why there's a construction zone there. But yeah, there is plenty of room to do that. But again, you'd have to, you know, pay for that, and somebody would have to put that into the plan. And we know how much people in this state love building roads down in Olympia. So, yeah. So, I mean, it's you, no matter what happens, you probably should have left today.
Right. I mean, tonight.
Like, you know, leave Thursday, or, you know, go really early Friday morning, even later tomorrow. We've found sometimes when we've left and tried to head to the coast, where, okay, we'll leave like at one and think we're beating the crowd, and then we get stuck. And then there are times we've waited until like 7 o'clock and had a 3-hour drive and it's already gone through. So, yeah I mean, it kind of depends. I mean, sit and have a nice dinner with your family and then go.
Yeah, the later or the earlier you go or come back, it's the same exact thing. And I know, and I get it, because you're going to say the best time to return to your home is Tuesday. And, yeah, okay, or I can...
Super early Monday.
Kinda, it's one of those useless arguments points. So, I kind of wonder if we just should tell everyone, we're not going to give you any tips anymore on how to get places during Memorial Day or, you know, 4th of July, depending on when it happens. Because the truth here, realistically, you're not coming back on Tuesday or Wednesday unless you have a special job that lets you do that. Everyone's expectation is you're back in the office on Tuesday.
Yeah, and so it's one of those things where you just, as long as you go into the weekend knowing that you're going to be delayed and it's going to be kind of a frustrating drive behind a lot of, you know, fifth wheels and RVs, not to single them out, but they go slower on those one-lane roads in some cases. And, you can get behind, it can get frustrating, but you just factor that in on the front end and be like, okay, just put in some good music, hope the kids behave,
I understand why no one might want to go later tonight. Because, again, let's say you're staying local and you're going to the east side of the state, or you're going to have to pay for an extra
hotel
night of a hotel or two hotel rooms.
Another dinner, exactly.
And for what? For, you know, an evening where as soon as you get there, you're kind of going to bed within a couple hours. Yeah. So it just doesn't quite make sense.
Yeah. So it's, you know, it's one of those things where you just know it's going to be busy, and just plan for it, and, you know, have the right attitude going in, because it is going to be frustrating.
Where do people normally head for Memorial Day locally?
Yeah. You know, well, obviously this is the first kind of weekend. It's going to be a nice Memorial Day weekend too. So a lot of people head east to go camping, to go to, hang out, in central eastern Washington. A lot of people head down to the beach. So they, you know, head south. Some go to Portland. We even have a lot of people who head up through BC. And so pretty much everywhere you go to get out of here, people are going a variety of different places. But it's usually the I-90s and the I-5s that take the brunt of this. Of course, those are our two biggest freeways. I mean, no duh. But
405,
I mean,
are they still doing construction? They were doing it last night.
Where
from Renton going into to Bellevue.
Oh,
into
well, of course, that's still going. That's still going on. Yeah, because there aren't going to be, I don't think, any significant lane closures. If they are, they're going to be overnights because the widening project is going on there too. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, 405, let's face it, every afternoon trying to get down through Renton and trying to make that, you know, squeeze onto I-90. Yeah, it's terrible every day.
I-5 going to, and I'm only talking about Renton because last night we had our Freedom Series in Renton at the Carco Theater. By the way, we're going to air the Freedom Series tomorrow on the show starting at 4 o'clock. And my GPS, just calculating where all the traffic was, told me to go through downtown Renton. Can I just have a bone to pick with them? I love downtown Renton. It's a nice little quaint downtown. It actually feels much smaller of a city than it truly is. Yeah. Renton's not that small. Every other street, every other intersection is a light.
A red light.
And it's so poorly timed out, I want to strangle someone.
Yeah, it's not exactly, you know, sometimes the GPS leads us astray.
Yeah.
It's
just
it's
unnecessarily
be
just stop and go unnecessarily. Just give us 2 minutes of green all across. Let us just drive and then make us all stop. I don't understand why you're going for a second and then you got to stop. Going another second, then you got to stop.
I think it's time we get the city traffic engineer on the horn and see what they could tell you about that.
Well, that's your job.
Oh, well, okay. Well, I'll put.
I just gave you a choke point.
I'll get the city engineer on the horn and see what I can find out.
I just gave
out.
You
yes,
a
you
choke
did.
Point.
Hooray!
And while you're at it, go into Everett and tell me why Airport Road, making a left onto Airport Road right when you get off the freeway, about 2 miles away from what is it? What freeway is that?
What are you in Payne Field? Are you talking
around Payne Field?
So you're going on the Boeing freeway, 526?
526.
Okay,
thank
and you get
I
off there right
the
at Boeing and
yep.
Right there on okay.
Airport Road just to make a left because I'm going down to West Coast Armory North. In
okay,
Everett.
Yeah.
You will stay at that light for 4 cycles. It doesn't turn green.
Which way? Are you trying to turn left?
Yes, you're making a left
oh,
onto
right.
Airport Road.
Oh, that's right.
I
oh,
don't
that one.
Understand
oh, yeah.
that. And the last time I said it, we got a whole bunch of texts saying, oh, I know exactly the one you're talking about. The
I do now, too, yeah.
What is the explanation for that? I honestly can't figure it out.
Well, because they want you to think of all the wonderful things you could do in and around Payne Field. You know, you could go there are ballparks there. You could go check out Boeing. You could go to the transfer station
ooh.
Like I did last weekend and throw away some garbage.
I'm not nuts, right?
No, that is a very long
I should have asked
signal.
Cassie Frankly that last night at the event. We were chatting and it was just small talk, which I don't like doing. I should have asked that.
Well, she has other pressing issues.
No, I want that fixed. I'm going to send her an email. Chris Sullivan, thank you so much for stopping by.
Anytime, Jason.
You're listening to The Jason Rant Show.
The Jason Rant Show.
Here to react, Seattle talk radio host Jason Rant.
And the rise of soft-on-crime laws and policies have made it worse.
Our man in the Pacific Northwest, Jason Rant, is on that.
And you keep on bringing us these extraordinary stories from Seattle. It's amazing.
Long form.
Okay, everyone wants to know what happened with Tucker Carlson. There have been a lot of rumors, but there's only been one biographer who's been able to actually talk directly to Tucker, and he joins us now ahead of the release of his book, appropriately titled Tucker. Joining me on the line, Chadwick Moore. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Jason. Thanks for having me.
I think you and I had the honor of being not just regulars on Tucker Carlson Tonight, but Media Matters, I think, labeled us both one of the top propagandists from the show. So, you know, that is a notable honor for us both.
I'm proud to be in that basket with you.
Right? No kidding. So your book is called Tucker. It's technically an unauthorized biography, and yet you had some unprecedented access to Tucker.
Yeah, that's right. So I'm an independent biographer. And when, you know, this project came to me and I asked Tucker what he thought about it and if he'd be on board, he was like, yeah, sure. Great. Let's do it. You know, I really like your writing and come and hang out. And since then, this was over a year ago. He's just been an open book and just kind of give me anything I wanted and always open when I want to come and hang out or need to talk to him on the phone. And it's been amazing. And he hasn't seen a word of it. He hasn't asked to. He hadn't approved the cover or anything like that. That's the book.
Yeah. And what I always tell people, regardless of how anyone views his positions and his shows, he's one of the nicest, most supportive people you will ever meet.
Yeah, you won't find anyone left or right who has met him and won't say that about it. The left will begrudgingly say that about him, people who've met him and know him personally, that everyone says he's an all-around good guy, like a really good person, and also, you know, wildly entertaining and engaging and funny.
And clearly the most important voice on the right and the conservative movement. You spoke to him after the termination from Fox. How did that conversation go?
Well, we spoke just oddly enough that very day. We were supposed to have a phone call. I'd already finished the book, and I had a phone call with him scheduled. Just I had literally 5 questions, a list to ask, just tidying things up. Did I get this right? Can you explain this more? And then this happened. So I finally did get to speak to him. And the book has been updated. I've added a couple new chapters since then. I've interviewed him twice since the firing, but the first time was about a week after. And he was in high spirits. He was keeping busy, but he was still confused. And because they didn't give him an explanation. And they just called him up. Suzanne Scott, Fox News president, just called him up that Monday morning. He'd already written his monologue for that night's show and just said, we're taking your show off the air. Thank you very much. Goodbye. So when I first spoke to him, he was confused, but he said he didn't feel bad because he knew that he didn't do anything wrong. He said, I think his exact quote was, if I'd been caught sleeping with the makeup lady or had to go to rehab, I'd probably feel bad, but I didn't do anything wrong, so how can I feel bad? So he was kind of just still kind of grappling with that. And he just wants to get back to work, really. You know, he's still under contract at Fox. He's still a Fox News employee. So he's not been able to work, and he really misses that because he loves his job so much, and he loves what he does.
What was the reason, according to your sources, behind the termination?
So according to more than one person who would have intimate knowledge of the situation, they both told me that it was a condition of the settlement with Dominion, between Fox News and Dominion, and that that his show would be pulled off the air, and that this decision was reached literally moments before they're about to go to trial. And Fox News, even though Fox News felt they would win the case, they desperately didn't want to go to trial, this person said, because they didn't want Rupert Murdoch to testify. Now, Fox has denied this, and Dominion has denied this in a statement saying that they had no condition regarding Tucker Carlson's employment status in an agreement, oral or written, with Fox News. But of course, he's still employed, so Dominion could absolutely be telling the truth in that statement and not mm-hmm. lying, because he is still, you know what I'm saying there.
Well, all the statements that they released made it seem like it was very, very clearly written by a lawyer, where it gives you technical truth, but maybe is a little bit disingenuous.
Right, and a lot of people have said that as well, that it seems suspiciously technical.
Very clearly, right? I mean, and I think it was Megyn Kelly this week who made that point, where if you wanted to quickly dispel the notion that you had anything to do with it, you would just flat out say, yeah, we had nothing to do with this, period. We didn't ask for it. We didn't want it. We didn't suggest it. Like, there are lots of things that you could do, because you could very easily say, we would prefer you do this, but we're not making a demand, wink, wink.
Right, exactly. Yes. So the people who told me this information, they told me this before it started getting reported. So a few weeks ago, it was starting to get reported. And then there was a undercover Twitter video. I think it was James O'Keefe, of a Fox producer, who was saying this. I don't know that producer. He's not my source. But as this was coming out, I already had this information. And so we released the video on Twitter. So I felt, you know, I don't, while this is in the news, I should put out there what I know. And we should continue talking about this, because by the time the book comes out, it might no longer be in the news cycle.
Yeah. The name of the book is Tucker. It comes out in July. Chadwick Moore joining me on the line. Obviously, you had to update, you know, the tense of the book when talking about his show. But how would you describe his upbringing and its influence on his worldview?
Well, he was his father, Dick Carlson, was also a journalist, and I got to spend time with Dick, who's a really fascinating and colorful and great guy, who's had a really interesting life and a really interesting career in journalism. And so I write a lot about him in the book, and his approach to fatherhood, because their mother, Tucker and his brother Buckley, their mother abandoned the family when Tucker was 6 years old, and he never saw her again. She died in 2011. And so it was Dick and the boys for a long amount of time, and Dick brought them along on reporting trips to, you know, crime scenes, and he had this very kind of hands-off approach. He kind of had no rules and let them do whatever they wanted. In stories that are wonderful to read and write about, but in today's world would have had Child Protective Services call. And I think that probably had a lot to do with shaping who Tucker was, not only that kind of freedom and independence that instilled in him, but also he's a lot of ways like his father, and he often describes his father as his greatest mentor and inspiration.
Well, and it also seems like that's the role he tries to play for his kids.
Yeah, for sure. And although he's much more less hands-off than Dick was with his own kids,
sure.
He's more protective. But I think that also growing up in the household with just one of your parents, you do create a special bond with that one parent because it's the only one who's around. And I think that sort of shows between Dick and Tucker.
What do you think made Tucker the most important voice on the right? And it's funny because while he's clearly conservative, I don't think he was always viewed as this, you know, far right voice for conservatives.
Yeah, because he's not far right. I mean, he's a civil libertarian. You know, he's one of the big things that I think motivates his political impulses is just to leave me the hell alone, get the nanny state out of my life. And I think that he came along and his show came along at a time, not only his personality was a perfect match for the political climate and the world, you know, with after President Trump and during President Trump, but it sort of perfectly matched up with this attitude, this shifting of political winds where there is no real, it's hard to tell what the right and the left is or what conservative and liberal are. And he's this singular voice that speaks to so many people. I mean, a huge part of his, not only his audience, but also his guests on his show, people like myself, or former liberals, were disaffected Democrats, who or people at least identified as liberal at one point. And I think that rising tide of people leaving the left and the Democratic Party and waking up to all sorts of lies and corruption and shenanigans in our society, Tucker has been so perfectly situated to talk about that. Because he cares deeply about it. And, you know, and just his stances on, you know, anti-corporatism and anti-war, he was a singular voice in corporate media to really address those things.
And what was always fascinating for me, and I'm assuming you got a lot of this too, where folks would say that we, just to get on the show, have to take certain positions, that they tell us what to say, or some variation of that kind of criticism. And you know, I always point out I've never, ever, ever been told what to say. I've never been told I have to agree with him on everything. I don't view him as someone who would even care if maybe we disagreed on certain, you know, aspects of whether it's foreign policy or domestic policy. He's always seemed to me just been pretty open to other views. And yet he's called this fascist on the right who's a grifter in some instances or a true danger in others. It's always been weird, the criticisms that accompany anything tied to his show.
Yeah, and he's someone who he loves to debate, and and he's been a debater since he was at boarding school when he made the debate club a spectacle that every student wanted to come see because he was such a talented debater even back then. But he's the first person to admit that if he's wrong, he'll admit he's wrong, and he'll admit if he loses the debate. He really can't stand people who refuse to admit when they're wrong, even if they're handed photographic evidence. So you're right that I was a regular on the show as well, and you were never told what to say, and you're never, you know, and if they ask for some talking points and they did that, so they can get chyrons on the bottom of your screen, right? They never said, well, you can't say that, or no, we think we disagree with that. You know, it was never like that. So and his show, he, you know, also told me he never had any executives looking over his shoulder telling him what to do. The show was totally, the content was up to him editorially.
Yeah, and that's probably why it was such a success. And that's not to indicate that other shows are being told, because same thing. I'm on Fox all the time. I've never been told, hey, you better take this position or you can't take that position. It's always been, for me, total freedom to express myself, including in ways where I know the host disagrees with me. Kennedy and I disagree on certain issues. She's a libertarian. I'm not, so that's natural. There's going to be some conflicts, but everyone's been really, really supportive of whatever position you take. And enough can't be said about the Tucker team, who has been absolutely outstanding and a big part of why people know who I am and probably know who you are on a national stage.
Yeah, for sure. And he even, you know, he said to me, you know, on that sort of those lines, because I asked him about after the show was pulled off the air, I asked him about maybe if some of the issues might have been things like the war in Ukraine, if that might have been a reason. And he said, no, he said, you know, maybe I don't think so. And he told me very directly that, you know, the Murdochs are very pro Zelensky and he's not. And he was said they directly, Lachlan directly told him, we disagree on this war, but you can run your show the way you want and say whatever you want. And Tucker, and this is after his show was pulled, said, I was always super grateful for that. And I thought that was really cool that your boss says you can disagree with him on air. So that was nice to hear. And, you know, he had nothing negative to say about Fox when we spoke at all. He was just more confused.
Yeah. Well, he will be back. We know he's coming back in some form on Twitter. The timeline a little bit murky, but I imagine it's not going to be as long as some people on maybe the left would hope it would be. The name of the book is Tucker. It's by Chadwick Moore. It's going to be coming out on July 19th, but pre-orders are available right now wherever it is you purchase your books. Thank you so much for stopping by. I really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Jason.
Absolutely. You're listening to The Jason Rant Show.
The Jason Rantz Show.
Let's bring in our man in the Pacific Northwest, KTTH, Seattle Talk Radio host Jason Rantz. Great to have you with us to tell people a little bit more about this.
Jason Rantz is in focus now.
Jason Rantz, thank you for your reporting on that.
The quick hit.
So we got some good news out of the world of Ford. At least they have decided, thanks to a lot of public pressure that we talked about just a couple days ago, they announced that they will be keeping AM radio in their vehicles, that there was just a lot of pressure coming from lawmakers and the public to keep the AM radio dial in its future products. We got this announcement via a tweet from the CEO, Jim Farley. He said he was speaking to policymakers about all of this. And part of it is because of the emergency alert system that we talked about. And there are just there's so much emergency infrastructure tied to the AM radio band. And in times of crises, they need to be able to get to the masses. And AM radio allows for that in a very easy way, at least as far as, you know, government bureaucracy goes and getting in front of as many people as possible. It will be included in all of the 2024 Ford and Lincoln vehicles. He also said that Ford will allow software updates to owners of its electric vehicles that currently don't have any AM broadcast capabilities. He said customers can currently listen to AM radio in AM radio content in a variety of ways in our vehicles, including via streaming, and we will continue to innovate to deliver even better in-vehicle entertainment and emergency notification options in the future. This came, by the way, amidst bipartisan support. Again, there have been folks who have wanted to destroy AM radio simply for political purposes, where they tried to go after AM personalities, the big ones, Rush Limbaugh, Mark Levin, Sean Hannity, Glenn Beck, and Jason Rantz, and they failed spectacularly, right? I mean, conservative talk radio is a massive force. It informs, but also it gets people to the polls. And it gets people talking about the issues, connecting dots for what's going on and how people can push back against really bad policy. But from a lawmaker perspective, not only did you get Senator Ted Cruz leading the fight for AM radio, you got Ed Markey, who is the senator from Massachusetts, very, very, very far to the left. But he also understands the importance of just at least the emergency aspect, emergency broadcasting aspect. And so the two of them passed or introduced legislation that looked like it was going to pass that would require all new cars to include AM radio. That came after, and we talked about this a couple days ago, BMW, Volkswagen, Mazda, Tesla, they all indicated that, or at least the reports indicated that they were going to phase out AM radio in their vehicles. They were using the argument that electric motors could interfere with the sound waves for AM radio. And, you know, is that an excuse or is that just because there's this perception that AM radio is dying, which the numbers indicate not at all? It's rather funny. And, you know, at some point, does AM radio, the same as FM radio, need to change its delivery mechanisms and embrace digital? Yeah, KTTH, for example, has been embracing digital for a very long time, and not just because we have an app that we want you to download, which you should download, but because habits change. And like I said, I don't listen to the radio, period. Not traditionally. I don't own a car. And so I listen via the app or I listen via my Amazon Echo. That's the way that I tune in. And, you know, I imagine when I get a radio or when I get a car and it's going to include an AM radio, I'll probably do exactly the same thing, still connect via Bluetooth via the app. That's just the way that I listen. And I think a lot of this is generational, but there are a lot of people in the industry right now who are looking at this decision by Ford and breathing a sigh of relief, not just because, you know, the nostalgia value of embracing talk radio on the AM dial, but because it means, you know, our jobs are a little bit less insecure. And I say it that way because radio jobs are never secure. Entertainment in general, media in general, never secure, but it's a little less insecure. Because obviously, if you get rid of AM radio, well, that's going to impact our job. Scott Walker works for WGNS in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. I think I said that right. And he's one of these small area broadcasters that, you know, when you're a small city, when you're a small county, when you're a mid-sized city and county, this is all some people have access to as far as the radio dial from a local level that really talks about the local issues. And he spoke with News 5 Nashville about, hey, I'm glad Ford decided to change his mind.
I think it was a relief to a lot of broadcasters really around the country. Radio has been here for 100 years. In general, reaches 92% of the population of America. And it's a great way to communicate with folks on what's happening locally and what's to come.
Now, it reaches everyone. Doesn't mean that they're tuning in. That comment reminded me of a tweet, I think it was last night, by Chris Hayes, who made the point he was trying to dunk on DeSantis and the Twitter fiasco. And he made a point of, and you know what? Every day, I've never had an issue beaming our content into tens of millions of households around the country. Yeah, technically, tens of millions of Americans have access to All In with Chris Hayes. The reality is 1.2 million people watch his show. The average is probably a little bit under that. But the last ratings day was 1.2 million. So tens of millions technically have access. I mean, technically, I can say because we're on an app and we stream, billions of people have access to the Jason Rantz Show. But, of course, only hundreds of millions of people are tuning in. 1-800-465-8770 if you want to send me a text message. Don't forget, tomorrow we will be airing in full the KTTH Freedom Series, The Crime Crisis, featuring Everett Mayor Cassie Franklin, Sheriff Ed Troyer of Pierce County, SPD Chief Adrian Diaz, Kent Mayor Dana Ralph, and so much more. I hope you'll tune in tomorrow at 4 p.m. for the Freedom Series. You're listening to The Jason Rantz Show.